Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Bitco is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. Bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Thank you for downloading the Tech Central podcast. My name is Duncan McLeod. I'm in Johannesburg today to chat to Martin Lee, the technical lead within Cisco's Talos Security Intelligence and Research Group, for what I have no doubt will be a very interesting discussion on all things InfoSec or information security. I'm chatting to Martin today via a very fancy Cisco telepresence solution, which I must say looks a little bit like the deck of the Starship Enterprise. So it'll be interesting to see the quality of the audio in this podcast, since we're not using our usual recording gear. Martin is in Oxford in the UK. He's a certified information systems security professional and chartered engineer. He has more than 15 years of experience in the security industry and holds a Master's of Philosophy from Cambridge and an MSc in Software Engineering from Oxford University. Martin, thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Well, thank you very much. It's a great honor to talk to you.
First of all, if you don't mind, perhaps walk us through a bit about what your day-to-day work entails, Martin.
So I work within the Talos outreach team as part of a team that's spread out throughout Europe. So our role primarily is to understand the threat environment, to mine the enormous amounts of telemetry that we have within Cisco to identify the particularly interesting attacks that the bad guys are up to, the things that are slightly different and that indicate how the threat environment may be changing. When we find something interesting, we research it in great depth to understand exactly what's going on. And then, being the outreach team, our role is also to externalize the findings of our research so that others within the security engineering profession know that there are these attacks out there and what they need to do to protect systems. And also so that other people, you know, who have an interest in cybersecurity and protecting systems are also aware of the types of attacks that are out there and the importance of taking steps to protect their systems.
Okay, so let's start to dive into some of the big issues in the information security space at the moment. Now, Larry Ellison, the CEO, or the former CEO, I think he's the president now of Oracle, made some interesting comments this week. He said that cyber attacks involving businesses, it's really become a war with cyber criminals. Business, he said, is at war with cyber criminals, and the business is losing that cyber war. Is that hyperbole?
What I tend to do in my job, and I think one of the most useful ways of understanding what's going on, is actually to turn the problem around and look at it from the point of view of the bad guys. So criminality is something that's been with us since the dawn of humanity. As we are creating this new world of the internet and connected systems, what we're doing are creating new opportunities for bad guys to do what bad guys do, which is fundamentally to make money. So I like to think, if you think about denial of service attacks, So where you'll receive an email to say, if you know, unless you pay me so many $1,000 or rand or whatever, I will launch a denial of service attack against your website and take your company offline for a month. So we can look at this and think, well, you know, here's a new attack, and it actually can be absolutely devastating for organizations. If you're a small business and you have large amounts of your revenue coming in through your website, if that goes away for a long period of time, it's going to be very, very damaging to your business. However, what we're seeing here really is this is an old-fashioned extortion racket. This is the extortion racket which is being updated to the 21st century. You know, previously, if you think about gangsters of the 1920s and 30s that you see in the old Hollywood gangster films, you know, a gangster would control a relatively small geographical area, whether that's Chicago or the East End of London or something like that. And yeah, they would control these streets. They would go around the small businesses and basically menace them to say, you know, unless you pay me protection money, I'll put a brick through your window or burn down your business. You know, wouldn't that really ruin your day? And indeed, yes, businesses would pay to keep the local gangsters happy. With the internet, in the same way that this enables a small business to sell throughout the entire world, it also enables criminals to take this same business model of extortion and move away from applying this in a relatively small geographical patch to doing it to the entire world. So what we are seeing are traditional crimes being updated for the 21st century and taking advantage of all the benefits of the internet, but applying this to criminality. So from my point of view, it's not so much that there's a war that's going on or that things have changed drastically. What's happening is the internet is providing opportunities both to businesses, but also to criminals. And we're in this moment of flux at the moment, where we have very innovative criminal groups that are taking advantage of the internet to conduct what are fundamentally traditional crimes, but update them to the 21st century. And yeah, we have to live in this world, we have to operate in this world, and we have to ensure that we have the protection necessary to protect ourselves and our businesses from these kind of attacks.
Are businesses in any way equipped at the moment to deal with these threats? I mean, talking generally, I know obviously some companies will be taking this stuff very seriously, but talking broadly, is business doing nearly enough to offset the risks that cybercrime presents?
So, I mean, our role within Talos, so Talos is the security research and the threat intelligence branch of Cisco. We have many people, we have 250 full-time security analysts looking at the types of attacks that are out there and building the detection engine so that we can block them. So the short answer is yes, we can block the attacks that are out there. We know how to do it. We know how to design both systems to detect and block these attacks. We know how to design networks that are resistant against attacks. We know that we are equal to the challenge which is out there. The problem is often one of people sticking their heads in the sand and thinking, oh, it won't happen to me. I read about this in the press, I read about the types of attacks that are out there, but it's happening to other businesses. And, you know, I've got an anti-spam filter, I've got a 10-year-old firewall, and what more do I need? And really, it's, I think what we need to fight against is that complacency and think that, mm-hmm. you know, really understand that, yes, cyber attacks can happen to anyone. And we need to make sure, I think really as a society in general, that we have the protections in place which are there to protect ourselves from these attacks and also from how the attacks are evolving and changing over time. So it can be done, but it can only be done if you're taking it seriously and you're actually considering the problem and what the risks are.
So it requires leadership inside organizations. Is this something that should be dealt with within the traditional IT function? Is this something that CEO himself or herself should be taking responsibility for? I mean, we've seen some examples of some very serious breaches in the last in the last few months. We've seen what happened at Equifax. The CEO lost his job along with other top managers at the organization. Whose responsibility is this stuff at the end of the day?
I think actually it's everyone's responsibility, to be honest. Cybersecurity begins at people's inboxes. You know, when you get that unexpected email coming through and you think, oh, should I click the link or not click the link? You know, you got a lot of people like, oh, you know, I'll just click it. What's the worst that can happen? Which goes forth and yes, the worst can be pretty bad. Through to people who just don't know, or, you know, clicking links in web browsers or an email that maybe they think that they shouldn't. I mean, this is where cybersecurity starts. It starts with that awareness that there are bad things that can happen, and you need to be aware of it. You know, it's nothing to be afraid of. There are wonderful opportunities out there, but we need to be aware of it. That then translates up the chain, certainly to a managerial level, where when we are developing systems, developing systems that are treating information, potentially sensitive personal information or financial information, to think beyond, you know, what does the user interface need to look like? How do I need my staff to interact with this system? But also to consider it from a security point of view and to think, well, okay, this data is really valuable. It's valuable to our customers. It's valuable to the business. What do I need to do in order to protect that? Full, all the way through to, as you say, certainly to the chief executives, to start asking the question, well, okay, well, what would happen if I got breached and this hit the press? You know, what would this do to my share price? What would this do to my business and also to my career? So throughout that whole stack within a business or an organization or society, this is something that we have to be aware of. It's something that we have to think about. We have to take our responsibilities seriously. Yet at the same time, it's kind of like crossing a road. You know, yes, it's dangerous. We need to teach our children to look both ways. But at the same time, roads bring enormous benefits to us. Exactly the same thing is true for network systems and the internet. There are enormous, enormous benefits here. There are great possibilities to be seized, but we need to be aware of our responsibilities. We need to be aware of what could possibly go wrong and design in the protections so that, one, we're minimizing the probability that something bad is going to happen because we're keeping as much bad stuff away from our systems as possible. We also need to recognize we're not going to be able to stop every attack at the perimeter and to think, okay, if the bad guys did get inside my business, how would I detect that? You know, how would I recognize that there was attack actually happening to me? And when I do recognize it, what am I going to do? How am I going to resolve? How am I going to react to resolve that incursion and resolve that breach to minimize the harm? And it's all about taking steps to reduce the probability that an attack is going to be successful, and then also increase our capability to minimize harm being done both to the enterprise and also to society.
I was going to ask you, what are the right and wrong ways to deal with an information breach? We saw what happened to Equifax. There have been other high-profile examples. I'm the CEO of a major company, and we've just had a major breach. What should happen next? What, as the CEO, should you do immediately?
The trick really is to make sure that the major breach doesn't happen. Sure. You know, that's really where the emphasis needs to be. There's enough, right, case studies out there of what can go wrong that I think all executives need to look at and learn from. The trick is more in taking the steps necessary to make sure that the breach doesn't happen. And that's about hardening networks, keeping the bad stuff outside of your systems as much as possible, being aware of what normal looks like within your systems so that you can spot when the abnormal happens. When that abnormal happens, the key thing is be able to react to it quickly. And this is one of the key metrics that certainly we talk about in Cisco security, that time to detect. How soon can you detect that incursion so that you can do something about it? If the bad guys are getting in your network, spreading throughout it, are going after your digital assets, if they're able to do that without you actually necessarily being able to see them, then the bad guys are in control here. You know, they can do anything and you're not aware of it. If you know that they're there, if you know where they are, you can then take the steps to block them and stop the incursion going on to become a breach. When the breach happens, and it's something that I think all organizations need to do now, is to think, well, okay, well, what could happen? How would we respond to that? A breach has an entire life cycle. It's typically only the very end play that we see that hits the press when, we have these high profile breaches that have hit the press recently. But leading up to that point, there's an entire life cycle that started from a bad guy having an idea or having some kind of goal, into going through some kind of reconnaissance phase about thinking, well, how can I attack this organization? Getting inside, spreading out the attack, spreading out their footprint within the organization, identifying where those key data sources are, which they're going after, being able to gain access to that, and then being able to exfiltrate the data. So ideally, what an organization wants to be able to do is identify every single part of that attack. You want to identify it as early as possible and just block it. You know, find out who's targeting your systems. How are they trying to get in? Block it. If they do get in, make sure that you can identify them quickly. If they do get in and you do identify it, then have the plan in place so that you can remediate the attack, stop harm being incurred. If you have incurred harm and there has been data stolen, again, have the plan in place. What are you going to do? Who are you going to call? An analogy that I often use when I'm talking to executives is this is kind of like analogous to fire. You know, I'm sure if you look up in the office there, you'll see a smoke detector, which is, you know, there to identify when something is happening. I've no doubt that you've got a fire exit there, so that if the fire, you've also got a fire alarm. So you've got detectors to spot when something bad, i.e. fire, is happening. That'll set off the smoke alarm or the fire alarm, which will alert people that there's something bad happening. You've got fire drills, you've got fire exits so that people know exactly what to do in the case of a fire. And I'm sure every single person within the organization knows exactly what number they've got to phone to summon help when a fire is detected. And I think we need to start thinking about cyber breaches in exactly the same way, having those detectors, setting off the alarms, training the staff so that we know what to do, and also remembering that you won't necessarily be able to resolve this on your own, but to have that help lined up in advance of knowing exactly who you're going to call and exactly what they're going to do to help you out and resolve the situation.
I suppose one of the differences between the fire and information security is that you can't always detect when there's someone's broken into your systems. And in many instances, you find cyber criminals breach your systems and can be in there for months or longer, stealing information, monitoring your systems, and you don't even know about it.
You've got to look at it in the right way. That like any crime, the bad guys leave, you know, their fingerprints, digital fingerprints all over your network. If you know what it is that you're looking for, you will find them. You know, if you think about the old fashioned style idea of the detective with his large magnifying glass, looking for fingerprints at the scene of the crime. You can use your network in the same way. If you've got bad guys on your systems, they will be using the network to probe other systems, to attack other systems, and also to exfiltrate the data. So you can use your networks as sensors so that you're able to distinguish between legitimate activity and malicious activity. So you can detect incursions early, but only if you're looking at the data in the right way and looking at the telemetry, analyzing the telemetry, and using the tools that you have available, and those potential tools, in the right way. So you know you've got all sorts of things, the desktop clients that you can have on your laptop, the one that we produce within Talos, AMP, we're able to identify when there's malicious software on endpoints, and also when crossing the network. We spend a lot of time writing rules and detection systems for firewalls, for the next generation firewalls. So again, we know what that malicious traffic looks like. We know what reconnaissance traffic looks like. We know what the command and control traffic looks like from malware. We can detect it. We can block it. So really, my recommendation would be to use your systems and use your networks to your advantage and use them as sensors so that you can detect the bad guys. If you're not looking for them, you'll never see them. If you know what to look for, if you've got those tools in place to enable you to find them, you can find the bad guys and you can remediate the attacks early.
So, Martin, we're talking about security inside the enterprise. Yeah. Their own infrastructure and network, et cetera, inside companies. But we're moving to a new era now of cloud computing. Both companies and individuals are putting more and more information, sometimes critical company information, in the cloud. Is it really safe to be doing that?
Again, I mean, it's like anything in IT. You need to be aware of the risks, of both the risks and benefits of doing this. From a security point of view, one of the ways that I like to get people to think about cloud computing is it's somebody else's computer. So if you replace the term cloud with somebody else's computer, I think it makes it easier to think about the security. So I'm going to upload my information onto somebody else's computer. If that cloud provider or that provider of somebody else's computer has better protection in place than you have in your own organization, then actually, yeah, this is a really, really good idea. You know, the large cloud providers have the in-house, or tend to have those in-house security teams with the security analysts who are looking at the network traffic, who are identifying incursions, who are certainly patching the machines and certainly monitoring physical access. So if all of that meets your needs and is being done better than you could do it yourself, absolutely, go for it. You also need to consider at what point does the protection provided by the cloud provider end and yours begin. So certainly if you're using the cloud to run your own bespoke software, then you wouldn't expect the cloud provider to be able to secure that bespoke software that you yourself are providing. There's also things such as user access as well that you'd need to think about. Again, this is unlikely to be something that the cloud provider is providing, but you know, there are solutions out there that can do that. You know, how to protect the cloud is one of the things that's a priority for us at Cisco. And again, it goes back to thinking about the problem. Yes, there are benefits here. Yes, this could be a much simpler, easier, and cheaper way for us to secure our data. But we need to be sure that the provider is providing the right level of security for us. And we also need to be certain where the provider's responsibility ends and where the customer's responsibility for security begins. But again, if you start thinking about it like that, it does become quite simple. People tend to overcomplicate security, I think, in many ways. And it's just a matter of looking at the problem in the right way and considering the problems rationally from the right way and just having the right levels of protection in there. So there's no reason why putting stuff in the cloud can't actually be more secure than having them on-premise.
Provided you have the right rules and policies in place.
Provided you thought about the problem, that you know what level of security that you need, and you've talked it through with your cloud provider and read through their policies and made sure that that meets your needs and requirements. So same as anything else in engineering, you know, it's what I'm buying going to meet my requirements and my needs. It really is no different from any other form of engineering.
Okay. Let's talk a bit about ordinary consumers, you and me. I, for one, was quite lax about security until earlier this year. I reused passwords across websites, for example. I tightened up, though. I now use a password manager. I patch my software constantly. I use a VPN when I'm in a public hotspot, etc. But what should ordinary consumers, and ultimately consumers, the people working in companies as well, so, you know, they're tied together, I guess. But what should ordinary consumers be doing to secure themselves better? What are the key messages?
I think the first thing, all of this begins with awareness of the problem, of awareness of the types of things that can happen. And if you start from a point of being aware, then you can start doing something about it. The other thing to think about is any extra layer of security is better than none. So I'd recommend the very first thing to begin with, that desktop protection, have desktop antivirus. That's got to be your absolute minimum. That and a spam filter on your email. If you've got that already, you're not doing too badly, and you're probably going to be protected against an awful lot of attacks. The other thing to think about, it doesn't need to be expensive. There's a lot of free and open source tools out there. Within Talos, we provide a lot of open source security. We provide our own desktop protection Immunet, which is entirely free for end users to use. I have that on my home PC in the front room. It runs there. I know the technology behind it. I know I have complete confidence in it that it's going to detect any malware which comes through and tries to run on my system. We also have consumer level protection for DNS at the DNS level, so open DNS. We have both the corporate level protection and also the free consumer level protection. This way we can block any malicious domain names. So if you have malware on your PC that tries to phone home, if it's phoning home to a domain that we've identified is malicious, we can block the initialization of that connection and prevent the malware actually from doing anything bad. Spam it still remains a big problem. A lot of attacks have been spread over email. Having that spam protection in place helps an awful lot. What you want to do, keep those malicious emails away from your inbox as much as possible. And then being aware that, if something slips through and it doesn't quite look right, chances are it isn't right, and just don't engage. Don't click the link. Just delete it, move on, forget about it. But if you've got those necessary protections in place, then you're doing something right, and you're probably going to be okay. You're going to have good enough security. I think for a lot of people, both consumers and enterprise, what we need to do is have security which is good enough for our needs. We don't need to live in Fort Knox in a vault to use the internet. We just need to have the security necessary to allow us to go about our daily lives. And for a consumer, yeah, if you've got desktop protection, you've got an anti-spam filter. If you want to use something on top of that, like OpenDNS as an extra layer of protection, you're probably doing okay and you'll probably be all right.
What about outdated software? I know a lot of people who are still running Windows XP on their home computers. Is that a bad idea?
Yes, yes. It's a horrendous idea. Patch. Same, yeah, with everything, patch. So many attacks get in through unpatched systems, through not having installed those downloads. So certainly, we're getting a lot better in the consumer space now that a lot of software updates itself automatically. Certainly Windows 10 has a pretty good software updating system behind it. Other things, Google Chrome is another very good example of something that just updates itself, that you don't need to worry about it. Any other software packages that you've got installed on your computer, yeah, absolutely patch it. Because if it's unpatched, or let's put it this way, patches come out because someone has identified typically a vulnerability in the software. And if there's a vulnerability, it's something that the bad guys can use either to get a toehold on your system or to get a persistent access to it. If you're patching those systems, if you're keeping up with your patches, then you're just removing those means that the bad guys can get within your systems and onto your computers. If you think about it from an enterprise point of view, think about it from the bad guy's point of view. If I'm trying to hit your enterprise and I find out that you're fully patched and it's going to be really difficult for me to get in there, chances are I'm just going to go and hit your competitor instead that doesn't have quite a strong patching policy and is easier to get in. So yeah, patching, really, really important. Also key to remember that in certain applications, it's not possible to patch. If you think about certainly lots of medical equipment, which can only be used if it's been certified, it's being certified to a particular patch level. And so in many systems, certainly in industry as well, certainly in healthcare and systems that can't be switched off in order to provide to apply a patch, it might not be possible to patch. So although in the security industry we'll say, yeah, patch, we recognize in some situations it's not possible. What you can do in those cases, and this is one of the key things that we do within our security research department, is we write the rules which detect attempts at exploitation on certain vulnerabilities. So for these systems, these key systems which you cannot patch, if you put them behind a next generation firewall, then and apply the rule updates to the firewall, I must say, we can detect and block any attempts at trying to actually exploit that vulnerability and get within a system. So even if you cannot patch, which happens, if you've got the right security in place, if you're protecting these systems with a layer of firewall protection, you can protect them, you can keep the bad guys out, even if, for sometimes very good reasons, you cannot patch.
Almost like putting up an electric fence around something that you can't put burglar bars on.
Yeah, absolutely. Put a moat around something. You know, it's not going to be perfect, but yeah, it's going to be pretty good at keeping most of the attacks out. You know, medieval castles are a very, very good analogy. If you think about how castles operated, you'd certainly have lots of people coming in with goods to sell and merchants coming in and out. So you can't just completely, you know, separate it from the rest of the world. But you've got a moat to keep out, anyone who's not coming in through your front door. That front door gateway, we've got a drawbridge, we've got a guard looking at who's coming in or out. If there's any indication of an attack, that drawbridge is going to come up, the portcullis is going to come down, and the bad guys aren't getting in. Again, if you think about the architecture of a castle, we've got those ring of walls around the outside, so those perimeter defences. We've got the gateway, which is being monitored. So we're monitoring traffic coming in. We've then got a courtyard, again, which is being monitored. So if something comes in, you know, waving a sword or a pole axe or something, you can see it and take action. And the crown jewels, the really, really important stuff, they're in their own keep, a mini castle in the middle of the main castle, which again has an extra layer of guards. It's got that extra gateway, which is being monitored, and only people with the right permissions are allowed in and out of the keep. And that's how you protect your crown jewels. You can think about enterprise security in the same way. Identify what's really important to your organization, stick that in a keep, extra layers of protection around it, extra layers of vigilance, defend the perimeter, monitor your gateway. The bad guys are going to go elsewhere.
This episode of Game of Thrones is brought to you by Cisco Talon.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I wanted to move on a bit and talk
Please.
About, you mentioned medical equipment, other types of equipment. I've just returned from a telecommunications conference in Cape Town where they were talking about ubiquitous connectivity, the world we're moving into, specifically 5G, Internet of Things, fiber to every home, etc.
Yeah.
Let's talk a bit about Internet of Things specifically, maybe. The idea is that everything is going to have an internet connection, have an IP address, my fridge, my toaster, everything, my car. As we go into that era, how do we manage security?
You know what? I find it so exciting. I blame a lot of this actually on Gordon Moore, one of the founders of Intel, who came up with the famous Moore's Law, that the processing capacity of chips is going to double every 18 to 24 months. This law has kept steady since the early 60s, and despite every few years people predicting that, you know, it can't continue, there are physical reasons why this cannot continue, well, it's going pretty strong. So it won't last forever, but the implications of Moore's law are that not only are chips becoming more powerful, but for any given power of chips, that unit price is getting cheaper. So when I think back, my first computer that I bought as a student, which is now 17 odd years ago, cost me £1,000. I looked up the figures. That computer that I bought has a fifth of the processing capacity of a $5 Raspberry Pi. So $5 Raspberry Pi Zero, five times more powerful than the computer I bought 17 years ago, you know, which was a big brick, you know, size of a suitcase. Raspberry Pi Zero, I mean, what is it? It's not much bigger than a credit card. That is going to continue. So chips on systems are going to get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. This is what is powering the Internet of Things. So I think whether we like it or not, the Internet of Things is going to happen. Exactly what the applications of the Internet of Things are going to be, I have absolutely no idea. If I did, I'd be investing in it now, and I'd be a millionaire in 10 years' time. But although Moore's Law has increased this power of chips, if we look at software engineering, so the physical engineering of chips has improved massively. Software engineering, we're not seeing the same improvements. If we look at the number of vulnerabilities according to the CVE project that were found last year and compare that with 10 years ago, it's roughly static. We're identifying the same number of software engineering vulnerabilities over 10 years. We're not seeing the same benefits that have happened in chip design. Ultimately, this is what's leading to our problems with security. The software that's being written has vulnerabilities. Bad guys are being able to take advantage of that. They're adapting their business models to these new ways of being able to take advantage of stealing CPU cycles or stealing bandwidth. So what we need to think about, I think, really as a society is how we're going to fix this. My take on this ultimately is that I don't think people are really very good at writing software, or we've come to the limits of people being able to write software. I have no doubt that sometime in the medium future, we're going to move to a model where we have much, much more automated analysis of software so that we can identify vulnerabilities before they get into production. We're not quite there yet. What we are able to do now is identify when vulnerabilities happen and get them patched. So that's a key thing about the Internet of Things, being able to apply patches swiftly to resolve any security issues. We also need to think, again, because the Internet of Things is going to be all about cheap chips and cheap processing capacity, what kind of security can we deploy which is really, really cheap and easy to manage? Because if you're the IT guy and you're trying to manage 10,000 devices throughout a city or something, there's no way that you're going to be able to look after these singly. So we have to have automated systems that can make the management of these systems easy, can also define what these IoT systems are able to do and able to connect to, so that we can identify when they become compromised, and also apply patches quickly and easily. So, I mean, it probably won't surprise you. I mean, this is something that we've been looking at Cisco. We've got a number of solutions that are available now for protecting Internet of Things systems. But I think it's going to be really, really interesting to see how this evolves over time. There's actually a superb case study in, I believe it's Cape Town. I can't remember. It's either Cape Town or Johannesburg that introduced Internet of Things, Internet-enabled traffic lights that connected over, it was probably a 4G or 3G network. And in fact, our enterprising bad guys discovered that they could just open up these devices and steal the SIM cards and sell them on. So it's not always going to be evident to us how the bad guys are going to abuse these systems. Certainly the bad guys will be, you know, it's a world of innovation of thinking, well, you know, how can I make money from this? How can I apply a criminal business model? So I think we're going to see new criminal activity associated with the Internet of Things. Exactly what that is going to take the form of, I don't really know, but certainly we can envisage a lot of the protection is going to be down to one, what are these systems, where are they, how do I define the network policies about what they're able to do and to connect to, what protocols are they allowed to talk, and then how do I patch them and how do I patch them quickly and easily.
I was interested, Martin, in what you said about the limits of software engineering. To what extent is artificial intelligence going to play a role in the future in mitigating attacks, identifying threats, etc.?
Well, do you know what? In security, we've been using artificial intelligence for years. If I look back, I started in the world of spam detection, and we were applying Bayesian analysis to detect spam then, and that was 15 years ago. So that's a machine learning artificial intelligence. Now it's just the run-of-the-mill anti-spam technique. It's just what people use. So I think we tend to use this umbrella term of artificial intelligence as a very vague thing, whereas in fact it's just encompassing a lot of techniques that we're just using at the moment. As we have more and more information and telemetry about what's going on and what's happening, we get to the point where that simply cannot be dealt with by humans. We have to move to an automated processing platform. A very good example, 15 years ago when I started in security, we were detecting about a dozen unique pieces of new malware per day. We're now in a world where there's 1.5 million unique pieces of malware per day. So 15 years ago, we were unable to analyze every new piece of malware by hand, have an engineer look at it, engineer protection. Now, there's absolutely no way that you can do that. A lot of this has to be done automatically. The great thing about that, machines are really, really good at doing the routine drudge work. And if we can offload a lot of the processing of telemetry and analysis of malware to machines, they can do that, you know, that routine work that just needs to be done, and we leave the interesting stuff to people and enable people to do what people do best. So people are incredibly creative. They're very, very good at sort of having a nose and be able to sniff out when something doesn't quite look right, use their intuition, use their sense of wanting to know what's going on, their curiosity, apply innovation, apply creation, and allow people to spot the really unusual stuff and get the machines, get the automated processing just to do the simple, boring stuff. We've got, 1.5 million pieces of malware to process a day. There's still probably about a dozen which are interesting. Great. Let's leave the people to do that. You know, at Cisco, we block 20 billion attacks per day. So we've got telemetry relating to 20 billion attacks. There's no way that we can do that manually. We write the automated systems, get the automated systems to do the vast majority of it, and enable people to what people do best, which is identify what's really interesting and what we can really react to and make a difference of as a person.
Before we wrap up our session today, Martin, I wanted to get your views on encryption. Some nation-state governments have been fighting this. We've seen the UK government basically suggesting that government should have a back door into programs like WhatsApp, etc., so that they can fight crime and terrorism. It seems to me personally to be a really bad idea. Is it? Is it a bad idea?
We bat on behalf of our customers. We do think that encrypting information is one of the best ways of protecting it. If you apply strong enough encryption, even if that data is stolen by a bad guy and exfiltrated, well, they can't actually use it without access to their keys. So we do believe that encryption is a fundamental piece of security. However, on saying that, we do follow the laws of the lands in which we operate. So, yeah, we follow to the letter the law as it is written by legislators and by politicians. But fundamentally, we do believe that encryption is a fundamental piece of security.
Okay, if we go to a world in which everything's encrypted, though. How do governments fight terrorism and crime? Sure, they've got legitimate reasons to fear encryption. I think the IT industry's taken a position that everything should be encrypted. Do we need a middle ground or?
There's a lot that you can do in analyzing attacks, even in the face of having encrypted information. So one of the things that we have done, and some of the technology that we've deployed, we've identified that there's enough metadata within an encrypted communication to be able to identify whether something is malicious or legitimate or not. So, the bad guys are certainly using communication in our own world of looking at malware command and control systems. Even if the malware is using encrypted techniques to encrypt that command and control traffic, there is often enough information which is not encrypted in terms of metadata, which allows you to identify whether something is malicious or not, even if you cannot see the actual communication stream itself. So again, it comes back to what I said about enabling people to do their jobs well. Even if something is encrypted, there's still enough signs there. Again, security or information security is all about looking for those fingerprints, looking for those digital fingerprints that the bad guys are leaving. Even if something is encrypted, there are still fingerprints there that if you're looking at the data in the right way, you can identify whether something is malicious. So just because something is encrypted, just because you can't see the content, doesn't mean that you can't distinguish whether it's malicious communication or not.
Okay. Martin, it's been great chatting to you from the deck of the Starship Enterprise. Martin Lee is technical lead within Cisco's Telos Security Intelligence and Research Group. Martin, thank you for speaking to Tech Central today.
Thank you.